Loving Heavenly Father, we thank you for the way in which you worked for your people in ancient times. And we take that as a promise that you can work on behalf of your people today. We see your hand in history, and so we see your hand in our lives today. And as we look at these scenes of ancient history, may we recall that you are a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and a God of our generation too. Teach us now through your Spirit, for I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, before we get to the slides, let me talk a little bit about Abraham and Genesis and Sodom and Gomorrah. The book of Genesis divides into four sections. There's Genesis chapter 1 to 11. We sometimes call that the proto-history or primeval history. Creation and the flood. And the second section of the book starts with chapter 12. And that's where Abraham comes on the scene of action. And the stories of Abraham last until chapter 26. Chapter 12 to 26. So there's 14 chapters in the book of Genesis about Abraham. But only 11 chapters about everything that preceded Abraham. So one man has said, it looked as if the writer of Genesis was in a hurry to get to Abraham. And maybe there's something to that. Because, as you know, Abraham was the father of the faithful. The Abrahamic covenant was the foundation of what later became the nation of Israel. So Abraham is a very pivotal character in biblical history. And when the Jews would engage Jesus in debate, they would say something like, "Our father Abraham did thus and so, or said thus and so." And they meant that in a very literal, biological sense. In the Hebrew language, there is no word for grandfather or great-grandfather. There's only a word for father. There is no word for grandson or great-grandson. There's only a word for son. So your father is every ancestor, however far back. And your son is every descendant, regardless of how many generations afterward. And so when they said, "Our father Abraham," they're using that word father just exactly the way somebody who speaks the Hebrew language would use it. And they meant it in a very literal sense. But Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am." He was the eternal, self-existent God, the member of the Trinity who came to dwell with us, the incarnate human God. And so he lived and existed on back into eternity and coexisted and worked and interacted with Abraham. Now you know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And you know the story of how Abraham's family got involved with Sodom and Gomorrah. His nephew Lot. Their flocks had increased and grown, and so there was tension between the shepherds of the two groups. Abraham's shepherds and Lot's shepherds. And so they decided they would separate. And so Abraham, generous man that he was, here we see his character coming through, offered to Lot the first choice. And Lot knew how fertile and lush the growth and vegetation was down in the valley. Doesn't look like that today, but you'll see some slides which show you that that land with irrigation can indeed grow crops. The Jordanian farmers used the land down at the south end of the Dead Sea for growing crops. It's an area right around the south end there that's called the Gore. In the Gore, the Jordanian farmers are working farms today. So with water, you can make that a very fertile area. And as people have studied climate through history, the time of Abraham, around 2000 BC, was a wet period. And then the second millennium became a drier period. And so we have the famines coming on. So Abraham stays in the hill country. Actually, he's living near Hebron, where we hear about so much political activity today. And so he really is living at about 3,000 feet above sea level. But Lot went down into the Jordan Valley and down to a city near the coast of the Dead Sea, which is 1,200 feet below sea level. So you drop from 3,000... You remember the parable or the story that Jesus told about the man who was waylaid on the road down to Jericho that was taken care of by the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan? The parable says, a certain man went down to Jericho. In 25 miles distance, you go down 4,000 feet. So it's really a very sharp incline, the road that leads down to Jericho. So Abraham is living near Hebron in the hill country, west of the Jordan. And Lot has removed down to Sodom. And as we have the record in the Bible, it was a very wicked city. And so we have one of the first cases of an investigative judgment in the Bible. The angels, actually Christ in a theophany, in an appearance, comes to the camp of Abraham on his way down to execute judgment upon the cities. And he reveals his purpose to Abraham. But Abraham knows, wait a minute, my family's in that city. And so he pleads. And in good Middle Eastern terms, he bargains. He bargains for the city. Well, now, Lord, you wouldn't destroy the city if there was 50 righteous people, would you? And so the price goes down. 50, 40, 30, 10. Okay. For 10 righteous people. And notice what Abraham says. Will not the Lord of all the earth do justly? So he is relying upon the righteousness of God, the mercy of God, and the justice of God. But when the angels arrived at Sodom, sad to say, they did not find those 10 people. And so the justice and the judgment upon Sodom, I should say it a little differently, the judgment upon Sodom was a just judgment. It was not carried out as an arbitrary, idle whim of God. Now that's the way the Canaanites thought of their gods, that they were at the mercy of the whims of the gods. And so they always had to sacrifice to him to keep them happy, so they could keep them on your side. Not so with the God of the Bible. He is merciful and he is just. And his mercy and justice are blended together. It's not that they're in tension, in opposition to each other. Sodom and Gomorrah first appear in the Bible story in Genesis 14. And because Lot was living there, he and his family and their possessions were taken by the kings of the east. Abraham goes in pursuit with some of his Hittite friends living around Hebron and their retainers, and they go in pursuit. And they are victorious in their defeat of the kings of the east, and they bring them back. And as you know, the story of the payment of tithes to the king of Jerusalem at that particular time. So the people were able to go back to the city from which they had been taken. But that doesn't mean that they were any more righteous. They didn't learn their lesson. Abraham, the righteous representative of the true God, had demonstrated to them the mercy and justice of God, but they didn't learn the lesson, and they continued in their evil ways. And so now, between Genesis 15 and Genesis 19, comes the story of the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. So that's the biblical background. Sodom and Gomorrah play an important part of the background of the Abraham story for about five chapters of the Bible, from Genesis 14 through Genesis 19. But they never, ever crop up any place else in the Bible except as secondary references. In Jeremiah, I think it is, and in Jesus' words, he refers back to Sodom and Gomorrah. But there are no references to Sodom and Gomorrah as living contemporary cities at any other time, later time after they were destroyed. Now you can draw an implication from that. It probably signifies that those cities were never settled again. We can learn a little bit more about these cities. We can learn a general bit of information about their location by looking at the story of Abraham. He is living near Hebron in the hill country just south of Jerusalem. And in the morning when the destruction comes, Abraham gets up, he looks down to the east towards the Dead Sea and sees the smoke of the cities going up. That gives you a general location. Down in the direction of the Dead Sea, probably along the eastern shore would be a better location than the western shore. So that brings us to the theories about where Sodom and Gomorrah were located. Basically, you have about four possibilities. Some people think Sodom and Gomorrah were under what is now the deep end of the north end of the Dead Sea. That's not a very popular theory, although one fellow went scuba diving looking for them and didn't find much there. The most common and popular theory has been that they were under the water at the shallow south end of the Dead Sea. Now, at the north end of the Dead Sea, the north end of the Dead Sea is 1,200 feet deep. The south end of the Dead Sea, until recently, was only 20 feet deep. In fact, in Roman times, there used to be a road which crossed showing that the water level was lower in those times. The water level of the Dead Sea has fluctuated. There was a Roman road that went from the eastern shore to the western shore across the south end, the shallow end. And that Roman road was used by travelers, showing that the water level was lower at that time. Now, a very interesting occurrence has happened recently, and that is that the Israelis have been pumping water out of the Sea of Galilee for agricultural use. And that's why you see a lot of the lush growth around the Sea of Galilee in the north. But that has another effect. It has the effect of lowering the amount of water in the Sea of Galilee, and therefore lowering the amount of water that flows through the Jordan River, and lowering the amount of water in the Dead Sea. So what has happened in the last 15 to 20 years is the shallow south end of the Dead Sea has dried up. And that has given archaeologists access to look at that area. And there's nothing there. Just mud flats. No remains or ruins of any ancient cities. So theory number two, that it was under the shallow south end of the Dead Sea, has kind of gone by the boards. But there has been a series of discoveries that actually started all the way back in 1922 that have gradually built up and built up to show us where some really good candidates for Sodom and Gomorrah are located. So I'll give you a little bit of the background of these discoveries, and then we'll start looking at the pictures. The story starts in 1922. The leading American archaeologist of this century was a man named William F. Albright. He lived and worked in Jerusalem for 10 to 15 years. And in 1922, he took a Model T Ford and went up and down the dry wadis of dry riverbeds of Jordan on the Jordanian side of the Dead Sea. And when he did, he came to a site which was located on the Lisan Peninsula. Now, the word Lisan is the Arabic and Hebrew word for tongue. And so as you look at the rectangular shape of the Dead Sea, which we will see in a minute, there is a peninsula that sticks out into it, and that is called the Lisan Peninsula. At the neck of that peninsula, Professor Albright found a site which obviously had been used in some way in ancient times. He thought it was a cemetery. Now, he believed in the historical existence of the cities of the plain. And he thought the cities of the plain were under the shallow waters of the south end of the Dead Sea. And he thought that the site that he had found was a cemetery, so that the people who lived in the cities of the plain down in the plain, which was not yet underwater, came up to bury their dead in a cemetery. 20 years went by. Nothing much happened, except that he finally got around to publishing the pottery that he had picked up on that site. It's very simple, very plain pottery, as you will see, which means it comes from the end of what is called the Early Bronze Age, 3rd millennium B.C., about 2000 B.C., plus or minus a century or two. Nothing more happened for another 20 years. And then all of a sudden, the antiquities markets in Jerusalem began to be flooded with the very same kind of pottery that Professor Albright had described. This plain, simple, globular pots with the ledge handles and no paint, no designs, nothing special. Rather primitive and rather early. And this stuff came pouring into the local antiquities markets. You know, when you are a villager and you can get $25 a pot, that's better than you can earn in working for a summer. For hard work working for an archaeologist. So, this means that some villagers someplace had made a find, had made a strike. Now, the man who was living at the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem at the time was a man named Paul Lapp, L-A-P-P. In fact, he taught at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. That's where he came from. Paul Lapp did what good archaeologists do when the villagers start bringing in pottery. He paid a little of what is known in the Middle East as bakshish. Pay some tips, a bribe, to find out where this stuff is coming from. And what he found out was, it was coming from the very site that Professor Albright had described in 1922. This is 1966 now. So he went out there and conducted 2 short seasons of excavation, about a month each. And what he found was, this is not a cemetery, this is a city. And so, the name of the site that is located at the neck of the peninsula is Babadra. That's the name of the modern Arabic name for the ancient site. Babadra was producing all this pottery. There's a city there, and there's also a cemetery. The cemetery is about a kilometer away from the city. And it's a very, very large cemetery, which means the population of this city was fairly heavy for when measured by ancient times. So Professor Lapp dug there for this period of 2 months, and he had his materials collected, but then he died. Rather tragic accident. He died in a scuba diving accident off the coast of Cyprus. So his materials lay fallow for another 10 years. And then finally 2 young scholars, Lutheran scholars, from Pennsylvania, one of them, Tom Schaub, and the other one teaches in Indiana, Walter Rast, were given the materials of Paul Lapp to get ready for publication. So they got to thinking, and they said, isn't it strange how this site, this one individual site, sticks out like a sore thumb with nothing else anywhere in the area? And so they said, before we publish this material, we better do a survey of the area. And so they went to the southeast shore of the Dead Sea and they did survey work along that shore. And what they found in the summer of 1976 was four more cities. Now, this begins to look really interesting. Because if you remember the story in Genesis 14, where it lists the cities and it lists the kings who ruled there, there wasn't just Sodom and Gomorrah. There were three more cities. And of course, the Bible trivia question is, can you name the other three cities of the plain? Well, let me give you a little help. Aside from Sodom, the lists, notice that the lists always read in the same direction. They always start with Sodom and end with Zoar. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. Those five cities. So these are called cities of the plain. Now, to be a city of the plain doesn't have to mean that the city is in the plain. The city can be located at the edge of the plain and still belong to it. Let me illustrate. In Egypt, there was a particular place for building cities. You didn't build them right down in the Nile Valley, because if you did that, you would use up valuable farmland. You didn't build them out in the desert, because that's where the cemeteries and that's where you buried the dead. So the cities were built at the edge of the valley, so that you preserve that farmland. And so it's the same with these cities of the plain. The ones that the modern archaeologists have turned up, they're not located in the plain, they are located at the edge of the plain, right where there is a geological shelf, and these five cities ring that area of the valley. Now, from their survey work, they could already tell that these were sister cities. There are a number of features that we'll look at which will show you that they are sister cities. The cities were laid out the same. They tend to be rectangular with a tower at the east end to protect the city from anybody attacking from the east. They are all located up on the geological shelf. They all have a wadi or dry river valley that runs by them. They all have a permanent springs. They all have the same type of late early bronze pottery found in association with them. They all have the same burial customs. So here are five, archaeologically therefore, from the archaeological features of these cities, you have five sister cities. Now, when did these sister cities exist? According to the pottery, which comes from the end of the early Bronze Age, these cities existed down to about, plus or minus, 2000 BC. They were all destroyed. They were destroyed at the same time. They were destroyed by burning. Three of the cities have now been excavated, and ash, sometimes in very sizable quantities, have been found in all of them, the three that have been dug. In one of them, even before the excavations, you could walk by and just scoop up handfuls of ash and charcoal. So after their destruction, about 2000 BC, they were abandoned. And none of these cities were ever built on again. Now that matches another feature of the biblical story, that Sodom and Gomorrah, as active living cities, disappear from the scriptural record after their destruction in Genesis. And the only references to them are later references back to the early Sodom and Gomorrah. So we have five sister cities archaeologically that have all the same features, that were destroyed about the same time and never settled on again. And in the biblical record, we have the five sister cities for which we have the names which we know of as being in existence and destroyed in the time of Abraham. Well, when was the time of Abraham? Well, you get those dates by adding up dates as you go backwards. And the historian works from what is known back to what is unknown. And so you start with the time of Solomon, because the dates for the kings are pretty well known. And you add the 480 years of 1 Kings 6, and you get back to the Exodus about the middle of the 15th century. And then you add the 430 years of Exodus 1240, the period of the sojourn in Egypt, and that takes you back to about 1880. And then you add the 215 years for the overlapping lifetimes of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because Jacob is the one that goes down to Egypt. And that's another 215 years. So you add that 215 years on to 1880, and you come to about 2100 BC. So, in round figures, Abraham entered the promised land of Canaan about 2100 BC, and if you knock off a few years, Sodom and Gomorrah would have been destroyed, let us say, about 2075 or something, right around there, in round numbers. So, with that introduction to these discoveries, let's look and see what we have. And if we could have the ceiling lights off now. This is just a map. It's a map of Palestine. It's turned what you might think 90 degrees to the right. It shows the coastline of the Mediterranean at the top of the map, and it shows the Dead Sea down at the left lower corner. And you can see the Dead Sea is kind of a rectangular shape. And there's the Lisan Peninsula that sticks out into it over at the left end. And the names and the roads that you see are the names and roads of the cities of Canaan and later Israel. Now the Jordan Valley is part of the great Rift Valley system. And this Rift Valley cuts north to south, or south, from north to south, and goes on into East Africa. And all the way along this is what is known as a plate geologically. And when those plates move, like the plates in California move, you get earthquakes. And so this is an unstable region that has approximately 5 major earthquakes per century, according to historical records. Well, here now we are looking at a close-up of the south end of the Dead Sea. At the top of the map, you can see the Lisan Peninsula that sticks out into the blue of the sea. You can see the first river, the first wadi. Now, that does not always have water in it. It only has water when the rains come in the winter. But there is a permanent springs right next to the site. So the top one is Bab Adraa. Then if you come down, there's another river there, but no site with it. And then you come down to the next one, and you see the name, perhaps a few of you up close can read the name of Numaira. These are modern Arabic names. Sometimes modern Arabic names preserve ancient names. And this looks like one case where that might have happened. If you take the word Numaira and you change only one letter, the first letter, and you put a G in the place of that N, you end up with Gomorrah instead, or Gomaira. Simply a matter of vowels after that. Gomorrah of Numaira. So it looks like there may possibly be a survival of an ancient name there. The next one down is, and you can see the person who made the map has put the question mark Gomorrah, the suggested name. And then we come to Safi, which is the third city down where the third little red triangle is, and the third river that runs in from the east. And then the next one down is Pipha, and that is also located on a similar river, dry river wadi bed. And then finally, the littlest one at the farther end is Kanazir, and at least has a suggestion about the last half of this name possibly having something to do with Zoar. So two out of the five names look like they might potentially have a tradition of the biblical names behind them. These are modern Arabic names today. These are the sites that were found by Rast and Schaub in their survey work of 1976. And so here are five cities, five sister cities, located along the, you'll notice just exactly where they're located, right along the edge of the plain. So they belong to the plain. The people from those cities worked in the plain. They did their agricultural down there. But they lived on a site on the bluff overlooking that. This is the old theory. This is the south end of the Dead Sea to the left, the deep end to the right. And the old theory was that these sites were located at the shallow south end. Then when they were destroyed and the water covered them up, the ruins would have been along the lake bottom there. But unfortunately, with the now dry mudflats in that area, no archaeological remains have been found in the area. Here's a close-up of the Lisan Peninsula as it sticks out into the Dead Sea to the left. You notice the road that runs down from the right. You probably can't read the name Karak, but it says to Karak. Karak was the ancient capital of Moab. And so the highway or modern road from Karak runs down to a place where the road, it joins the road that runs north and south. And it's right at that juncture. That is where Baba Draw, possibly ancient Sodom, is located. And so the Antiquities Department, I guess I got that one backwards, sorry about that. It's a little too fine print to read anyway. The Department of Antiquities has put up this map and writing explaining about the excavations in the area. And this is the Wadi Karak. This is looking up the Wadi Karak to the east. And one thing that has happened, one wall of this city was located along that river valley. And in 4,000 years of time since then, that wall, the northern wall, has fallen in. So the northern wall doesn't exist today. Now the eastern wall and the southern wall and the western wall, the stumps of those walls still exist. And, well, that's the sunset. Got that one wrong too, but. And this one is the map. Now, here we are, the Wadi Karak looking west. So this is looking, the first one was looking to the right or to the east, and this one is looking to the west or to the left, down as you would go down towards the Dead Sea. And a little bit of the site is located right along this shelf on the south side of the bank of this river. Here's a map of the site. You will notice the meter rule at the bottom. From 0 to 200 is 200 meters or 200 yards. And if you take that rule and superimpose it on the site, which is above, you can see that this site was about a little under 300 yards long. That's the length of 3 football fields. So this is a pretty good sized city by ancient standards. Now, you can see they have drawn the double lines which outline the walls along the east and along the south and along the west because they have found the stumps of those walls there today. But you'll notice the dotted lines for the wall on the north side of the city, and that is because that wall does not exist. It has fallen into the riverbed. Also along the south side of the city, along the bottom of the slide, is the modern highway that runs by here. Now, you'll notice that there are a couple of cross lines across those walls, and that is where the archaeologist has dug. And so they have concentrated a little bit on the east end of the city, a little bit on the west end of the city, and they've also dug across the south wall, and they've also dug a residential area inside the city, demonstrating that it was a city. Well, this is kind of the same archaeological map. The site is at the top of the slide. And again, you see the trenches of the archaeologist to the east, the trench in field 8 that cuts across the south wall, the squares that have been dug in field 12, which is where the residential area was found, and a cut across the western wall. So this is how the excavations have been carried out on this site. Now here's an aerial photograph of it. At the bottom, or cutting vertically across the slide, you see the modern highway, the highway that comes down from Karak. Then if you see where the numbers are, you can make out kind of a faint outline of a wall. It's not a full wall, it's just the stumps of the wall. But where number 11 is located, Roman numeral 11, that was the tower at the east end of the city. And where field 8 is located, that's where they cut across the wall. And where field 12 is located, that's where the residential area was excavated. Now, the archaeologist doesn't know what's underneath the ground when he starts. So he lays out a square, a 5-meter square, and then he starts digging. And when he comes down on something, what he comes down on may not line up with the neat walls in his square. It's where the ancient people built. And so you'll notice the angular wall across the left upper corner of this square. That is the wall of the Eastern Tower. Now, the purpose of this wall was basically observation for the purpose of defense. You see, this city had a very good defensive position. It's located at the leading edge of the rock shelf over the Jordan Valley. And as such, it had a commanding position for any enemy that would attack coming up out of the valley. But they were at not so great an advantage if anybody came across the plain from the east. And so they were more vulnerable from that direction. So they put a tower, an observational tower, at that end of the city so that the people observing the area, if any enemies came down out of the hills and across the plain towards the city, they could sound the alarm and get the troops ready and so on and so forth. So this is the tower. And this is what it looks like in excavation. Now, the stick that you see with the colors there, that's a meter, 3 feet. And that stands against what was the superstructure, or what's left of the superstructure, of the upper part of the tower. What you see in the level below is the foundation. These are limestone blocks that were used for putting the foundation in, and then mud bricks were used for the tower up above that. So if you add all this together, even today, it stands at about 7 or 8 feet of it is left. And this is what you would see. If you were an ancient guard posted on that observational tower, and you look to the east, you see this long plain, and then at the end of the long plain, you see the hills of Moab, the mountains of Moab. And the city of Kerak is up in those mountains. So if the ancient Moabites came down out of there and came across the plain to attack these people, or some Amorites or whoever from the east, they would see them and give sound the alarm and ready the troops. Can anybody figure out what this is? $64 question. It's not ancient archaeology. It's modern archaeology. Sheepfold? Well, what about parking something in there? What would you park in there? Camels? A truck? How about a tank? A tank. Now, you have to recall that this site is on the east shore of the Dead Sea. And when you stand on this site, you look across the Dead Sea, and you look at what country?
Israel.
And you're standing in the country of Jordan, and they have not been very friendly over the past 5 decades. 3 wars have been fought back and forth across that border. So for a time, this site was not accessible to the archaeologists because it was a military reserved area. And so the Jordanians would had emplacements where they would cut a tank garage down into the soil of this archaeological site for camouflage purposes, because the color of the paint on the tanks was very close to the color of the paint of the desert. So this is not ancient archaeology. This is modern archaeology. This is the doings of the Jordanian army. All right, back to ancient archaeology. This is the south wall of this city. And I want you to get a little bit of an idea of the size. Now, again, you see a meter rule, and that meter rule says with the little tiny numbers that only I can read, 2 meters. Now, the wall is what you see at the top. But, of course, it's not a nice, neat wall because that wall, in 4,000 years, the blocks have fallen off that wall. So you're basically looking at the stump of that wall. But if you start where the cut is on the right-hand side, and you measure to the cut on the left-hand side, and you use your meter rule, you have at least 10 meters, at least, perhaps a little more. 10 meters is 30 feet. The wall of this city was 30 feet thick. This is not a minor little village. This is a city that had very formidable fortifications. And there is a city that was located in a very tectonically unstable area. How do you like that for fancy highfalutin language? a tectonically unstable area is a euphemism for saying they had a lot of earthquakes there. And these people knew that. And they built their walls accordingly. Now, if you build one long wall, let's see, I just want to hang this up for a minute. If you build one long wall, just in continuation, when an earthquake comes, that wall will shake like you take a hold of a snake by its tail. But they learned that if you build walls in segments, every place there's a joint, the wall will give, it will shift, and it will not damage the wall nearly as much as if you just knock the whole wall down. So this is a joint in the wall where the anti-earthquake technology was applied by these ancient people. Well, this is just a view across the western end of the city, and it's the slide is dark, and the room is light, and so it's a little difficult to see. This is another shot of the same area, a little lighter. You can see a little boy walking across it. As you look at this, it looks like the landscape of the moon or something like that. You wouldn't realize that there was an ancient city under there until you start digging. And when you start digging, then you start running into structures like these. Can't see them too well, but what you have in the right lower corner is a wall and a room to the left of that wall and a room to the right of that wall. And there's more. This, about the upper third of the slide, there's a walkway between the rooms. And then there's a large wall which runs up and down in the slide. It's rather wide. You can see there's a meter rule. And so this wall is about 2 meters thick. And then it's interrupted by the walkway between, and then it continues on the other side of the street. This is where they put the houses, where the houses of the city were built, where people lived. This is another picture of the west end of the city, also rather dark, but you may be able to see the archaeologist's squares where they have cut down into the wall. Some of these cuts were made by Paul Lack back in 1966 when he said, "This is a city, this is not just a cemetery." Now this is a limestone block, but you'll notice it's very pockmarked. And this is what happens to limestone when you put it under intense heat. It's called sintering. It's all these little pockmarks in the rock. And so this is a symptom or a sign of the heat with which this ancient city burned. And that is also testified to by the ash on the floor of some of the houses. Now this slide in the foreground, in the lower part of the slide, is a later village. There was a village built here about 500 years after the city was destroyed, but it was not built on the site itself. The actual site of the city is at the top of the slide, and that is the wall of the city. What you see there across the horizon at the top of the slide is the wall of this ancient city. And if we have better lighting and a little more amplification of the slide, you might be able to see three people standing at the far left end of that upper wall, which gives you an idea of the size of this wall. Sorry you can't see them. You'll have to take my word for it that they're there. All right, here, and we're looking now to the southwest. This is the direction of the cemetery. And this is a very interesting and a very unusual cemetery. Now, the earliest part of the city, this is the way they made their tombs. They cut a shaft down through the rock, and then they made a burial chamber. Now, when the population is small, you can do that. But once your population gets larger and you have more people dying at any given time, this is not a very efficient way to form a cemetery. And so, just to give you an idea of what this is a top view looking down on the burial niche and the hole that's down the shaft. And you might be able to see the drawings of the pots and jars and the bones in the lower burial chamber. This was a replica of this, which was put up at the Smithsonian Museum. The pots on the left are real. The skeletal material is real. The matting is a replica that has been made in modern times. And the circular area of the tomb is a modern replica. But I want you to notice these pots. I told you that they were very plain, very simple, just globular pots with a neck. And there's even a stone vessel down at the left lower area. Now, notice also the matting. The reason they put that in there is because they found bits and pieces of matting like this. And that becomes an important part of the story. But these are the early tombs. Now, the population gets larger. So you have to have a way to make more burials. And what they did was they made these burial houses. This is an aerial photograph of these burial houses. And so you see those rectangles. Each one of those rectangles is a burial house that has been cleared out by the archaeologist. And there's about 50 of these have been excavated so far. And each burial house would contain between 50 to 70 burials. So if you dig that shaft down and make one shaft chamber there, you can only put 3, 4, 5 burials. But now with these, what we would call a mausoleum, and now as you make these burial houses, you can you have much more opportunity for more burials for a larger city, serving a larger city. Now the interesting thing about these burial houses, the city was burned, the burial houses were burnt also. Now that's very unusual. Actually, I do not know of another case of a cemetery in the Middle East that was burnt in ancient times. Now think for a moment of the biblical story. It says fire came down from God out of heaven and burned the cities. What is your conception of how that fire would strike those cities? Do you think the fire was aimed so that it only fell within inside the walls of the city? Or would it have all just splashed down there and burnt the hillside and the countryside around it? I would suggest the latter. And that when the city burned, the charnel houses, as these are called, also burned. Now, how do we know that? Well, this, you can see the walls, the stumps of the walls. There was more wall and there were roofs. The roofs were made out of wood, and they were made out of branches, and they were made out of mud that were put on top of that. They fell in, and they fell in on a floor that was burning because you could see the burn marks on the matting that was on the floor. And the burn had burned partway across the room, then the roof fell in, put out the fire, and left the ash marks of where the burn was. Now, the archaeologist has cleaned out all of the skeletons and all of the pottery out of this particular example. Here's another one. They have cobbled stone floors. The entryway is at the right upper top and the wall down at the left lower corner. Here's a close-up of the corner. They were made with limestone blocks. And here's the pottery that is found in these. Now remember the plain, simple, round pots that were found in the early ones. Now what you see is they're developing some angles, some curves, some paint to painted designs to their pottery. So this is an advance. This is a development. And this is the kind of pottery that was found in the burial houses. The simple old pottery was found in the shaft tombs. The now developed pottery is found in the charnel houses, the latest period of the city. And this pottery date gives us a period of about 2000 BC. The other pottery is a little older than that. And here's some more of the pots that were found in these tombs. Little juglets. Rather delicate little designs, I would say. Nice little handles. Globular juglets. So this is the pottery. Early Bronze IV type pottery. From the end of the early Bronze Age, end of the 3rd millennium BC, about 2000 BC, which gives us an archaeologist's date for the destruction of the city in approximate round terms. Now, as they cut across one of these charnel houses, here's a drawing of the cross section. And what I want you to notice is how many times and how many places, those of you who can read it up close, it uses the word ash. For instance, in the middle, right in the middle, it says loose, bricky, burn. And down at the bottom, it says red ash. And then that's on the right. And then on the left, it says burn, cloth, string, and wood. So this is a symptom, or simply a demonstration, more of a demonstration,
of the fact that these charnel houses were burned. As I say, burning a cemetery in ancient times is extraordinarily unusual. I don't really know a parallel to it. But so this has proved a puzzle to the archaeologists. Why in the world would these people burn these cemeteries? So they have made some suggestions. One is that they have said, well, an enemy who marched through this area and conquered this area wanted to make sure they were free of all disease and germs. And so they burned them to sanitize them. Well, I'm afraid that's injecting Pasteur back into the ancient world. That doesn't fit very well. Well, another suggestion has been made that the people who lived in the city did this as a cremation rite. In other words, when the final body, let's say this burial house accommodated 70 bodies. When the final body was put in there, then they burned the whole thing as a cremation rite. If that was the case, they did a very poor job of it. Because, as you can see from the burnt matting, the burn only goes partway across the floor. It's the problem of when you take a match and you put it in a jar, and sometimes the match that is burning will go out because of a lack of oxygen to support combustion. And so that's what happened in these charnel houses, in these burial houses. The fire came in from the door. Sometimes even the wooden frame around the doorway was charred. And then it burnt partway across the floor, and then it went out. And then sometimes immediately, or sometimes perhaps years later, the roof fell in and covered it all up. And that's why you have this sort of thing. Well, we're moving on to the second site. I seem to have gotten that slide backwards, but that's all right. You can get the idea. Just in your mind's eye, flip the slide, and you'll see the round tower. Again, you see the rectangular design and the round tower at the east end of the city. And this is Numaira, the second city down. And this is what it looked like. Doesn't look like much, does it? You'd think, well, that's just an ordinary old hill, right? Well, here are some boys that are walking across the hill to show us the general direction. The tower is actually off to the right. And here they're standing on the tower. And so you can begin to get a little bit of an idea. I'm sorry the slide is so dark, but there is a tower there. There is a valley or a wadi down to the north side of this. And then they started digging here. And again, you find the same thing that was found at Bab Adra, here at Numaira. And you can already see in some of the squares, some of the walls that the archaeologist has uncovered. And this is a little dark, but if you look in the right lower corner, you see a large round stone that has a cup that's hollowed out of it. What that is for is it's a post of a door. The door swings, and it's so the standard of the door will fit in that place and therefore be able to turn. So people lived here. Not only did they live here, but they ate here. And what you see here is the ancient equivalent of a modern grain silo. Now, modern grain silos are big and tall. Well, these are fairly big and tall. Actually, probably they already stand about 3 to 4 feet there. And as they threshed the grain and brought the threshed grain up and stored it in the city, they stored it in these clay bins that were modeled down into the floor of the houses. And this supplied the foodstuffs. Sometimes they made these storage bins out of stone. And so here you have two examples with the boys and the one on the left and the open one on the right, and grain from their harvest from the valley below was stored here. And that's what the people lived on. Now this is just kind of a scenic tour of the Jordan Valley. This is looking to the north and this is looking to the northwest. You can see they're standing on the west edge of the mound. You can see the rise up to the site, and that's the Dead Sea out in front of you, and on beyond, on the other side of the Dead Sea, that's Israel. This shows the leading edge of this ancient site, again, with the Dead Sea, the Jordan Valley down below. And here you can begin to make out a little bit of the colors of the mountains on the west of the Dead Sea, which is Israel. So Abraham would have been located kind of towards the right end, near the city of Hebron would have been located up in that general area. Another view to the south, and also to the south, and finally, directly due south, where the road curves around the shallow end, the dry end of the Dead Sea. So this is kind of a panoramic view of the Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea area, in this area. And we come now to a map again. And so the next site is Safi. We've looked at Babadra, we've looked at Numaira, and we're now looking at Safi. Now, excavations are currently going on at, I believe, Pipha, the next one down. At Pipha, they've had a little trouble finding the ancient town, but they have found a huge cemetery. A cemetery that is as big or bigger than the cemetery at Babadra. And so we'll go now to the last few sites. There's not much to see there. No excavations have been done. The ruins of the city at Safi are located in the right lower corner. And some tombs are located in the central part of the slide. And then what's up above is the agricultural area that is used in the valley today. And so this is looking at the hill on which the site of Safi was located. Again, you can see a valley to the north. You can see the site kind of sits up on a ridge. And no excavations have been done here yet, but you can see right here is just walking over the surface and looking around to see what you can find. Here's a stone bowl. A stone bowl like the stone bowl that was seen in the tomb. And you can see with the pen measurement, it's about maybe a little over 6 inches across. Obviously, this was handworked by human beings. It was used in some type of utilitarian use here in this ancient town. Here's the agricultural area of the valley. So this gives a demonstration of what you can do if you get enough water. Sometimes people have a misconception about the desert of the Middle East. The desert of the Middle East, I'm speaking of the countries of Israel and Jordan, is not sand. It is dirt. It is dry dirt. And if you pumped enough water in there, you could make the desert blossom as a rose. Now there are true sandy deserts like the Sahara. But the Middle Eastern desert in this area is dirt, dry dirt, very parched dry dirt, which could support agriculture and population with water. And as I mentioned, the climatologists, as they have studied the pattern of rainfalls, they say the third millennium B.C. was a wet period and the second millennium B.C. was a dry period. And this site kind of stood right at the transition point between the wet and dry period. So it must have been much more lush and much more attractive and inviting in the time of Abraham and Lot. And so Lot chose to go down into this area. The temperatures there are quite severe in terms of heat. Usually archaeologists like to dig in summer, the American summer, June, July, or August, because that's the time of the academic year, the vacation of the academic year in North America. But in this area, where you're down below sea level, it gets very hot very soon, so they like to dig about April is when they dig at these sites. More of the agricultural in the area. More of the agricultural, and you can see Israel on the far side. And you can see a little bit of the rim of the ancient site on this little promontory that sticks out and looks down on the valley. And a little more of the agriculture looking to the left or towards the south. And you may see the outline of a rock wall there that's kind of covered up. Would be a target for excavations. Now we come to Pipha. And as I mentioned, this is the place where the extremely large cemetery is. And you can see already before they excavated here, you can see all of the tombs of the cemetery to the far right. Again, the city has this regular rectangular shape, probably has a tower that's located in the center there towards the east end. It has the seasonal water flow, and it has the natural springs. and it has the agricultural land down below it, down in the valley. So I used to have a slide of the... We can turn off the projector now. Thank you. I used to have a slide of the last little site. I don't have any pictures of it. I did have a slide of the map. Yes, we can have the lights on too. So here we have five ancient cities, Canaanite cities, let us call them, that come from a very ancient time, 4,000 years ago. And they come from the time of Abraham. Now there's one missing ingredient. Unfortunately, it's a fairly vital ingredient. And the missing ingredient is writing. The easiest way to identify an ancient site is if you dig up something that has writing on it with the name of a city. Let me give you an example. Just north of Jerusalem, there is an ancient ruin mound, which the Arabs call El Jeb. And you might see or detect the idea that the name of Gibeon is embedded in that Arabic name of Jeb, Gibeon. The archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania, may I say, James Pritchard, went there to dig, and when he dug into an area that was kind of an industrial installation, and he found a lot of storage jars, and on those storage jars it had imprinted the name of Gibeon. Now that's beautiful. When you find that, that's wonderful. And there are at least a half a dozen or more sites in which that type of thing has been found in the Holy Land. But the problem here is, as far as we know to the present time, these people were illiterate. They had no writing system. They didn't write with hieroglyphs like they did in Egypt. They didn't write with cuneiform writing like they did in Babylon. And they didn't write with an alphabet like the later residents of Canaan did when the Israelites came. So that means we do not have any written material from these sites. Maybe some will be found someday. Let's hope so. It would be an extraordinary discovery if it was. What does the archaeologist do when you have a site that you don't have any written material from that will identify itself for you? What the archaeologist does is he looks at the archaeological profile. What does he have here? And then he looks at ancient sources. What can we find in ancient sources? Ancient biblical sources, ancient extra-biblical sources. And then he makes a comparison to see how well the two fit. Now let me make a suggestion of what we have here. We have an archaeological profile. We have five cities, no more, no less. They all come from the same period. They clearly are sister cities. They were built with the same architectural techniques. They were built with the same architectural layout. They were built with the same tower at the east end of the cities. They used the same pottery. And you've seen some pictures of the pottery as it came out of the tombs, as it was used in the last, later end stage of these cities. They had the same burial techniques. They started out with shaft tombs, and then they ended up with these burial houses. And that's common to the cemeteries of this area. They were located in a very similar position, all five of them. They were located on the geological shelf overlooking the Jordan Valley. They were located next to a permanent water source, a spring. They were located next to a seasonal water source, a dry riverbed that ran with water during the rainy season. They were located in that position for the obvious reason, all of them, so that the agricultural work could go on down in the valley, and their position fit very well as a defensive position. Anybody attacking coming up out of the valley would meet your front defensive wall and be at a disadvantage, And anybody coming from the east could be spotted very soon or very early before your arrival, so the forces of these cities could be alerted. Now, when you take that profile and when you look what to see what we can find in the Bible, we find that we have five cities of the plain. They're always listed in the same order. To me, that suggests they're probably listed either from north to south or south to north. I would guess from north to south. That is to say, Sodom would be the northernmost city and Zoar the southernmost city. The Bible says that these five cities of the plain were destroyed by burning in the time of Abraham. No further biblical references exist, or extra-biblical historical references for that matter. Sodom and Gomorrah and their sister cities disappeared from the historical tableau of peoples of the ancient Near East. And the only references to them are backward references to people that knew of the story of their destruction. Well, what can we say? It seems like to me that when you check every point that can be checked between the biblical sources from Genesis 14 to Genesis 19, and you check the archaeologists' findings from the excavations at these sites, that the match is virtually perfect. It's true, we lack the frosting on the cake. We lack written material from these ancient cities. But I can at least suggest to you, at the present time, on the basis of archaeological work that has gone on these five sites since 1976, that we now have very excellent candidates for Sodom, Gomorrah, and also Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. That's probably where I'll leave the discussion of these cities, but if you have questions, I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you'd like to ask. Yes? How many miles between the cities? Between Babadraw and Numaira is about 7 miles. From north to south, it would be a total of maybe 25 miles. Not far, but a considerable distance. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. You got me off on a whole nother track. All right, well, we have 10 minutes yet before we're supposed to dismiss. So, is your question related to Ron Wyatt?
No, the Dead Sea area back there, you mentioned it earlier, it's freezing right up, right?
Yes. As far as we know, yeah. Okay, the question is, how the area has dried up at the present time, and the question is, how deep was the Dead Sea before that? As far as we know, the 1,200-foot depth in the north end of the Dead Sea has always been there. It's been a feature of the geology that probably when the rift of the valley was settled from after the flood, that shelf was already there. So the depth of the Dead Sea at 1,200 feet, of course, immediately after the flood, it would have taken time for that to fill up. But since that time, the depth of the Dead Sea has been approximately stable, but it has fluctuated. It has gone up. You see, as you go through history, you have dry periods and wet periods, and dry periods and wet periods. And so, in a wet period, the depth of the Dead Sea would rise a little bit, maybe 10 or 15 feet, and in a dry period, it would go down 10 or 15, 20 feet. So, since the time of these cities, as far as we know, the level of the Dead Sea has been relatively stable within a margin of 20 to 30 feet. Now, I still have to get back to your question, but let's see. Let me try a few other questions, and we might save a period or part of a period to talk about that. Yes?
Does that make sense to say that was that part of the land of Canaan?
Yes. That's right. Mm-hmm. Correct. Actually, we have texts all the way up to central Syria. There is an ancient site in central Syria, actually northern Syria, by the name of Ebla, ancient name of Ebla, modern name Tel Mardik, where there are tablets, there is writing from this very period. And the name of Canaan as a territorial name is used in those tablets for that city, which is not restricted to what we would call Palestine or Israel today, but went on up into Syria. So the name of Canaan was not restricted just to what was west of the Jordan and south of the Jezreel Valley. The name of Canaan was a little bit more inclusive. Now, the accounts in Genesis 14 to 19 give the list of the seven peoples that lived in this area, and I never can remember those lists. There's the Zuzim and the, you know, it has a list. And so these are basically subdivisions of the Canaanites, kind of clan family groupings among the Canaanites. The overarching, there were two main ethnic groups, the Amorites and the Canaanites. The Amorites basically came from the north, and the Canaanites were the preceding population. The Amorites appear to have moved down into this area about 2000 BC. The Canaanites were the old population that was there before. Any other questions? Yes. Is your question, could the water have risen to have destroyed any ancient sites that would have been in the valley area? Writing. It's possible. Ancient writing was done on several types of material. Now, sometimes they carved a nice inscription on stone. I'm sure you've seen those from pictures of Egypt. But in Canaan, they more commonly wrote on leather, parchment, with ink. And this would disintegrate, would oxidize. You probably have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's what most of the Dead Sea Scrolls were. And it's just by a kind of freak accident that the temperature and climate in those caves that were closed preserved them. Now, it's an interesting story about the Dead Sea Scrolls. They have, of course, moved all of these scrolls and scroll fragments up to Jerusalem. They're in two different locations. And the main location is the Shrine of the Book. It's a museum which is right next to the Israel Museum, the great big Jerusalem City Museum. And the roof of this museum is shaped by the architect like the cap on the jars that held the scrolls. Very clever. They have had extreme difficulty in preserving those scrolls. You would think with modern science and technology, where you can control temperature and humidity and light, that we would be able to preserve them as well as the desert did. It doesn't work that way. The great Isaiah scroll that used to be in the center of the, you know, in a round glass container, has been taken out. So what you look at now is a facsimile of the great Isaiah scroll, which is about 26 feet long. And so the true Isaiah scroll is being stored under special conditions to try to preserve it. Now, what happens with leather or parchment, as it oxidizes, it turns black and it turns into glue. And so the problem is that the ink, which was black, you lose more and more definition between the ink and the leather as the leather turns black and oxidizes. So you're losing the script. Of course, all of these have been photographed, so the knowledge of what was on the scrolls has been preserved. Now, to kind of go back to your question, another thing the Israelites wrote on was broken potsherds. You know, there's broken potsherds everywhere on these ancient sites, and so, you know, they would write with ink on broken potsherds. So it would depend on what material they used for the writing as to whether it would have been preserved or not. And so maybe there's some there that we don't know about that we may yet find. It would be nice. Any other questions? Now, I still owe this lady an answer about the work of Ron Wyatt. Let me give you a quick answer now, and I'll give you a more expanded answer in the next, sometime in the next 2 or 3 days. Ron Wyatt is an amateur archaeologist from Nashville, Tennessee. He has worked on a whole series of projects across the Middle East. He's looking for Noah's Ark in mountains near Mount Ararat. He's looking for the Ark of the Covenant in the Garden Tomb area in Jerusalem. He's looking for Sodom and Gomorrah. This one bears on what we talked about today. He's looking for Sodom and Gomorrah on the west shore of the Dead Sea. And he says that he has found some sulfur balls there, and I don't dispute that. He probably has. But I have seen pictures of the area that he's talking about, and I have protested to him. I said, Ron, there isn't any archaeology there. It's only geology. You're looking at a barren countryside with these sulfur balls scattered around in them. And so he says, well, maybe they were all vaporized by the fire. Well, that's a bit difficult. If you look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atom bombs, the cities were destroyed, but they weren't evaporated. There were still ruins of those cities left. So if you're talking about a fire, an intense enough fire to utterly decimate everything, you'd have to reach temperatures above that of an atom bomb. Now, I wouldn't deny that that's not possible with God, but I would say that if all the archaeology is gone, you can't find it. There's nothing to speak to archaeologically. Another problem with Ron's work on Sodom and Gomorrah, I'm sticking strictly to that particular issue. Ron is not very well aware of professional archaeology that goes on in the area. He doesn't know about these sites. He doesn't know what's been found there. He's not aware of the reports that are published in professional archaeological journals. And so one of Ron's problems, and I know him personally, and I've talked with him a number of times. He's visited my office in Washington. I visited his home in Nashville. One of Ron's problems is he's kind of a lone wolf, you know, and therefore he isn't really aware of what other people in professional archaeology are doing with these sites all over the ancient Near East. And so, anyway, that's his particular work on Sodom. I've kind of stressed that a little bit because that's what we're talking about here. He feels that the crossing of the Dead Sea took place on the east side of the Sinai Peninsula rather than on the west side. Traditional discussion of biblical geography would put the crossing on the west side. He puts the Mount Sinai all the way out in Saudi Arabia at a place called Jebel El-Lawz. Now that one I'll discuss on Friday because I'm going to show slides of a little bit of Egypt and quite a bit of Sinai. So we'll talk about that one later. I would simply say this. Each one of his projects, and he has many projects going, needs to be judged on its own merits. Some of them may be fairly good, some of them not so good. And so the problem is that he presents all of this, and all of this is given by virtually miraculous occurrences to him. So there are some serious archaeological problems with his work. That's not to deny that he may have turned up some very, very interesting material. I've actually written a couple letters for him to people that he wanted me to write to them to fund some of his work. And what I said in those letters was, Ron Wyatt thinks that the Ark of the Covenant is down in this cistern by the Garden Tomb. I don't think so. But anytime you open up any cave or any cistern or any tomb in the area of Jerusalem, you stand a fairly good chance of finding some interesting material, even if it isn't the Ark of the Covenant that he thinks is there. So on that basis, you know, I'm happy to have people proceed. He did have a permit from the Garden Tomb people, and he did have a permit from the Department of Antiquities. As I understand it, they have not renewed that permit, so he's not able to dig there at the present time. So we can leave some of this for further discussion at other times. I think it's probably time to get you on your way to supper, but thank you for your attention. Tomorrow we will give a survey of the land of Israel from north to south, from Dan to Beersheba. Thank you again.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved.